You're listening to Central Time. I'm Dean Knetter, in today for Rob Ferret. Coming up, a small, dead-end Wisconsin town is the setting for a new novel by UW-Whitewater professor Ken Broski. We're talking about what inspired the writing and what encouragement he has for us to develop our own writing style. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with an update on the life of a Cuban Wisconsinite who lives in La Crosse. He's featured on the podcast WPR Reports, Uprooted.
Ernesto Rodriguez came to Wisconsin in the summer of 1980. That's after making a treacherous journey on a fishing boat from Cuba to the United States. Quickly after arriving on shore, Erne was shipped off to Fort McCoy in Sparta, Wisconsin. And it's in the military base's kitchen that he got a crash course in American food from a local cook.
One day he said, "Are you guys like macaroni and cheese? What the hell is macaroni and cheese?"
Erne has come to love mac and cheese and burgers. But as he first told us in the podcast, WPR Reports Uprooted, he also still cooks traditional Cuban food like congri and chicken fricasse. Erne has embraced life in Wisconsin, but has never let go of his Cuban roots. He's lived between two worlds, only able to walk in one of them, the U.S. He's dreamed of returning to Cuba for a visit.
Well, the first thing I'm going to do is go to my hometown, see if I recognize where I used to live, and then spend the time with my family in Florida.
Erne has been a permanent resident of the U.S. for decades, but he wasn't able to become a citizen due to paperwork issues with his Cuban birth certificate. That means he couldn't vote or get a U.S. passport to travel. That is, until fall 2023. Ernesto Rodriguez traveled to Minnesota, where he took part in a naturalization ceremony.
All right, if everybody can please raise your right hand, and you're going to repeat after me. I hereby declare...
After reciting the Pledge of Allegiance, Erne received his certificate of naturalization. He was beaming.
Yeah, American citizen. I'm happy. I'm excited. You know, it's big, big stuff.
He waited more than 40 years for this moment.
I feel released now because now I can vote. Now I can apply to be like La Crosse mayor.
He may be joking about running for mayor, but he's very serious about getting to vote. Erne grew up in Cuba and has only just become a U.S. citizen. He's in his mid-60s, and he's never voted in an election.
In 40 years I've been here, I have a sixth president, Jimmy Carter, Reagan, Bush.
He keeps up with politics in the news, so this is a huge deal to finally be able to participate in the democratic process. As for Erne's other lifelong dream, going back to visit Cuba, now that he can actually do it, he has some mixed feelings.
The only way I can go to Cuba is the whole government thing is throw away, throw to the garbage. If Cuba be free, then I can go there.
Erne is wary of the Cuban government. He misses his family, but even his sister discourages him from visiting. It's partially because he's been speaking out against the government and communism.
Cuba, you say, I don't like Castro, and there's people watching you, and they put you in prison for no reason.
Standing proudly next to Erne is Michelle Pinzel. They've been close friends for nearly two decades, so this day is emotional for her, too.
It's just incredible to see how patient and how diligent Ernesto has been in all of these years.
While Erne waits to vote and thinks about visiting Cuba, he has other things he wants to tackle first as a citizen.
Enjoying my life in a great country, America. Work to prove my life a little more and maybe buy a house and be a comedy, you know, stand comedy, make a joke.
But before he launches his stand-up comedy career, Erne is taking the day to celebrate. His first stop, lunch at a Cuban restaurant in the Twin Cities. His second stop, the Mall of America, so he can find a shirt or hat that features the U.S. and Cuban flags. To learn more about Erne's life in Cuba and Wisconsin, check out the podcast WPR Reports Uprooted at WPR.org/uprooted. Big thanks to Mark Rickers for recording the audio for this story in Minneapolis. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, there's a lot that can go wrong when we think we know what's best for other people. Hubris is at the heart of a new horror novel from our next guest, a Wisconsin writer and professor, and he wanted to explore taking that idea to an extreme and supernatural level. We're going to talk about some of the themes from his new book and where he's drawing inspiration, and we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you think small towns lend themselves to settings in works of fiction? Is it a setting that you like when you find it in a book? And are you a horror fiction fan? What do you like about reading books from that genre? What are some of your favorites? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Ken Broski is an associate professor of English at UW-Whitewater. His latest novel is called What Doesn't Kill You. Ken, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me. I'm a big fan.
Oh, thanks. And you are a member of the Horror Writers Association. You contribute regularly to genre publications. What do you like so much about reading and writing in the horror genre?
I like to be scared. That's one of the first things for sure that always sticks out with me. And I think also, I think we're sort of, this has been written about a couple of times recently, but we're definitely in sort of like a golden age of horror literature. There's so many different ways of writing it that authors are exploring, and they're coming up with some really interesting stuff. I tend to be more of like a classic horror writer compared to my contemporaries, but for me especially, this idea that horror can stand in for other things, I think makes it a really interesting avenue to explore. And also, I like monsters, so that's always a plus too.
Monsters are fun, yeah. What do you think makes for a really good fictional horror work, whether it's a short story or a novel? What makes for good, scary fiction?
You know, I think, you know, and I tell my students this a lot, I think the starting point really needs to be making sure that the writer knows about the conventions of horror so that they don't end up writing something that feels very generic or falls into a lot of tropes and cliches. I think once you know those elements of horror, I think you can really go above and beyond what people normally think of as horror. There's a lot of writers right now who like to write scary stories that involve how the body changes, for example. And that's always like a really interesting concept to explore from a horror perspective, because, I mean, let's face it, adolescence can be pretty horrific when you don't know what's going on with your body. And so there's a lot of writers exploring that. But I think for me especially, I start by thinking about what is scary, and then moving beyond that into thinking about, well, what scares the people that I want to write about?
Sure. And your latest writing is the book, What Doesn't Kill You. I want to turn to that and talk about, first off, the setting. It is the fictional Wisconsin town of Seven Sisters, Wisconsin. Can you talk to us a little bit about what it's like there in Seven Sisters?
So Seven Sisters is this classic small town that has sort of lost its luster as the result of a new road project that went in. And so it sort of went overnight from being right on this major highway route to sort of being like just a side road of a major highway route that moved. So it's got, you know, it has this one place of employment, which is the local grain depository. And then, you know, beyond that, it really is this town that's sort of just fallen into disrepair as the result of, the economic imbalance that occurs when a town basically has this meaningful economic shift. And so it's a really great location for a scary story, because what ultimately happens in the book very early on is that the town essentially gets snowed in during this pretty heavy blizzard. And because the town is, everybody who lives in the town is so close to one another, it almost feels like, as I was imagining it in my head, it almost felt like the sort of like closed Hollywood set And so I could picture, I actually drew the entire town on a piece of paper just to keep my head straight. And it was so easy to picture because it was basically this one main road that used to be a highway. And on one side of the road, you've got this grain mill located next to a railroad track. You've got a bar, you've got a little sort of all-purpose general store. And then on the other side of the old highway, you've got this horseshoe-shaped road where all the houses are on. And so as I was sort of like imagining the things happening in the story, I could always go back to that picture. And I was always reminded of, like, you know, just how isolated some small towns have become, especially if those towns are off the beaten path.
We're talking with Ken Broski right now, Associate Professor of English at UW-Whitewater and author of the new horror novel, What Doesn't Kill You. We're taking your calls, too, at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for our guest? Have you started writing some fiction of your own? How's it going? What's working? What isn't? And do you have a favorite horror novel you want to share? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Dean Kinetter. We continue our talk with Ken Broski, professor of English at UW-Whitewater. We're talking about his new horror novel, What Doesn't Kill You, set in a small fictional Wisconsin town. And Ken, I got to say, I think you nailed the small Wisconsin town setting. Having grown up in one myself, a lot of the details were ringing true. Things I've heard people say, observations I've seen people make. I also loved the energy, because chapter by chapter, you're bouncing around to different places and different people, but they all kind of know each other, which I think makes it feel a little more intimate. How does that everybody knows everything aspect, how did that figure into the storytelling here?
You know, it's funny. None of that really came in the first draft of the story. I think in the first draft of the story, I was really just trying to get, I knew I wanted this monster to exist in the story. I knew kind of why I wanted all of that stuff to happen. And then as I was sort of going through the revision process, I'm one of those writers who spends a lot of time going back and rereading and then making changes and then going back and making changes. And so for me, like layering that town history and trying to get a sense of how each person would know the other people in the town was really useful, actually. And it didn't come all at once. It sort of was this process. I was really inspired by, I went back and rewatched a TV miniseries called Storm of the Century, based on a screenplay by Stephen King. And the TV show is kind of funny because it doesn't really... It's kind of goofy sometimes, but at the same time, it was also like a really good examination of a small town living under duress. And so those kinds of stories helped give me a sense of just how much these characters needed to know about each other. And so as I was building it out, you know, piece by piece, family by family, it actually got easier as I was doing it because I started to know the characters better, and I started to know exactly what they would do in that situation. So that was my approach with the town as a whole.
And why did you want to explore hubris as a main theme in this horror story?
I had this idea. I had seen this picture of this statue, and there was a beehive that had been, you know, bees had built this beehive on the statue's head. And I was like, wow, this is a really scary image. And then I didn't think of it for a while. And then I had a horrible nightmare about this beehive statue chasing me, which, you know, I woke up and I was like, wow, that was really scary. I should write something about that. So that was kind of like the start. But then as I was sort of thinking about, like, well, why do I want this to exist in this small town? I started to pay more careful attention to social media in general. And one of the things that has started to like really stand out, the more I've been reading about social media, like Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and TikTok, is that the people who create those programs that get us addicted, they always think about what's best, what they think is what's best for us, right? They think they know what we want. They think they know what we will like. And that's why those algorithms sort of get us addicted to social media so easily, is because they've essentially designed this process for telling us what we want and, you know, thinking about what they know best about us is more important than what we think we know best. And so I took that idea and I sort of implemented in this small town setting. And then I threw in a scary monster because, you know, I mean, it's a horror novel. It's got to have a scary monster in it. And I don't know. I constantly think about that a lot, this idea that if we are, you know, if we're going to spend so much of our time on social media and the people running it always are making decisions because they think they know what's best for us, what kind of world does that create?
We're talking with Ken Broski, Associate Professor of English at UW-Whitewater, author of the new book, What Doesn't Kill You. Ken, I also wanted to get your thoughts on some writing inspiration for us. And with that in mind, I want to go to the phones right now. We have Jim with us in Juneau. Hi, Jim.
Hello. Thanks for taking the call.
You bet. Yeah, what do you want to bring up?
Well, first, there's actually two things. I've had this book in my head since I was a little kid, and I'm in my 50s now. So I wanted to know what kind of advice you could give for the getting off my ass, sorry, and just putting pen to paper. How do you go about doing that for yourself? Second, I would like to know, mine also is based on kind of a science fiction-ish topic. And so how do you keep from falling too much into that niche? How can you make it relatable?
Gotcha. Jim, thanks for the questions. Sure. What do you think, Ken?
So, Jim, I'll give you a couple of ideas as a starting point. I think one thing you probably want to start with is thinking about the inciting incident. In other words, you know, take your main character and before you write anything, jot down what a normal day in the life of your main character looks like. And then think about what is the inciting incident that is going to get, that is going to change your main character's life. And once you have that inciting incident, you can sort of leap into the story you want to write. I think one of the best things to start with when it comes to like how to figure out how to tell the story is remember the three magic words of storytelling. And the three magic words are therefore, however, and meanwhile. Okay. And therefore is one of the most important words because everything in your story, whatever you decide to tell in your story, should have purpose. There should be a reason it's being told. And so that's why in a lot of stories you see writers skip entire days. That's why in some stories you see, you know, writers will fast forward an hour or they might say something like the main character had dinner and then went out, right? And they don't mention the dinner itself because it's not important to the story, right? So the word therefore is really important because it'll keep your mind focused on what's important in the story itself. And then however is where you throw a wrench in the gears of whatever's happening. So anytime you want to ramp up the tension, you use the word however as sort of like that key word in your head that tells you that something unexpected needs to happen to your main character and they need to react to that. And then you need to think about how that affects the story, right? So for example, if you watch the original Star Wars, you have the two droids who land on Tatooine at the beginning of the original Star Wars. The however for them was getting caught by the Jawas and then getting sold to Luke Skywalker. And then, of course, Luke Skywalker deciding he doesn't want to go with Obi-Wan Kenobi. However, when he returns home, his aunt and uncle have been killed by the Empire, right? So that word becomes super meaningful. And then the word meanwhile, you can use to jump from chapter to chapter. Meanwhile is kind of like this opportunity for you to cut to a new scene in your head as you're telling this story. With sci-fi, this is especially important because readers don't need to get bogged down with the world building too much with sci-fi. They want to jump right into the story. So think about your main character's life. what is going to throw them out of balance? What is going to be that inciting incident, and how do they react to it?
Jim, thanks for the call. And Ken, thanks for that advice. We love to ask authors when they're on with us what they are reading. A little bit of a lightning round right now for you. Let's start with the horror genre. What's your recommendation right now for readers to pick up?
Oh, man. Well, I mean, you got to read What Doesn't Kill You, because I got to sell some books. Yeah, or my publisher is going to break my thumbs. But in terms of horror, I read another really good book called Boys in the Valley. It's by an author named Philip Fracassi. And it's kind of like the best way to describe it is Lord of the Flies meets The Exorcist. And so that's my horror recommendation beyond, and of course, my book, obviously. But I got some other ones. Should we do some other genres too?
We've just got about 1 minute left. How about mystery?
Okay, mystery. I would say definitely read Blacktop Wasteland by S.A. Cosby. He's a fantastic author. It's one of the best mysteries I've read in a long time. And if you have Audible or if you have a Libby subscription, definitely pick up the audio version because the narrator is fantastic.
And real quick, an all-time book recommendation.
I would say definitely Cloud Atlas by David Mitchell. It's one of my favorite books. It takes a little bit of extra effort to follow. But once you get the hang of it, I think you'll be in for just an amazing fantasy, sci-fi, mystery, humor. It's got everything. It's my favorite book of all time.
Ken, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Ken Broski is an associate professor of English at UW-Whitewater and author of the new novel, What Doesn't Kill You. Coming up after the news, a health psychologist shares what she's learned from living near the Arctic Circle about improving our mental well-being during the winter. I'm Dean Kinetter, in today for Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Dean Kinetter, in today for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Now, daylight savings ended this weekend, and Wisconsin is once again plunged into darkness every night before 5 p.m. But we don't have to dread the cold, dark days ahead. Research suggests that changing our mindset heading into the winter can make things a lot easier. We're joined by a psychologist and winter well-being expert about how we can embrace and enjoy the Midwest's harshest season, and we want to hear what you think. At 800-642-1234. Does your mood change when there's less daylight? Do you experience seasonal affective disorder or some milder variation of the so-called winter blues? Or is winter actually your favorite season? If so, what's your secret? What do you do? What keeps your mood up? Let us know by calling 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Carrie Leibowitz is a health psychologist, speaker, and writer. Her upcoming book, How to Winter, will be out next fall. Carrie, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, what do we know about why some of us do tend to get down during the winter? Is it the cold and the darkness and things happening physically? Is it culture? What's happening?
I think it's all of these things. So we have a physical response to the darkness, right? So the lack of sunlight impacts our energy levels, which can impact our mood. We might feel more sleepy. That's very normal. I also think it depends on our culture, where we grew up, and our mindsets about the season, which is what my research is about. So a lot of people, I think, start to see the winter as a really limiting time of year. This darkness makes people feel tired. They feel like they want to be less social. The cold might make it harder to go outside and do some of the things we like to do outdoors. And so when we view winter as this really limiting time of year, it's natural that we would feel kind of grumpy in response to that we would feel a little bit blech, like as the days get shorter and the weather gets colder.
Sure. So it's a normal thing. And here in Wisconsin, we have harsh winters, no doubt about it. You spent time living in Norway in the Arctic Circle. And those are winters. I mean, you had several months without any sunlight. What did you observe there about how people handled the winter season?
So I'm originally from New Jersey, from the Jersey Shore, where, you know, we care a lot about summer. And I moved to northern Norway to a city called Tromsø, which is north of the Arctic Circle. And as you mentioned, it's so far north there that they have 2 months of what they call the polar night. This is the time where the sun doesn't rise above the horizon for 2 full months. And I was really scared. I was really nervous about getting depressed. I was really worried about the cold and the dark. And I really felt like winter would obviously be a depressing time of year, because that was really the winters that I were raised, that I was raised in, really seemed to look at the season as a time of year that was no fun. But then when I actually got to the Arctic and I was living in northern Norway and talking to people, they had a really different experience of the season. They really enjoy the winter. I mean, they love winter sports and winter activities. So skiing is a really big one, but also ice skating and hockey and snowmobiling. They really see the darkness there as cozy, as relaxing, as peaceful. And winter as a time of year for sort of reveling in that coziness, slowing down, resting more, doing, you know, more cozy things inside in front of the fire. And so gradually through living there and being exposed to this different culture, this different way of seeing the winter and behaving in the winter, I became converted myself into something of a winter lover.
And I admit myself, this week, I've already been catching myself saying things like, oh, I'm dreading the darkness. Oh, it's going to get bad. I'm going to get lazy. Even if I'm not there yet, when you talk to people who weren't so worried about the darkness and the cold in Norway, what kind of things were they saying when it was coming up?
Yeah, Dean, you are not alone. A lot of people love to complain about the winter and sort of even before it's really begun, as you mentioned, to really talk about, you know, how they assume that it's going to negatively affect them. But in northern Norway, I found people talked about the things they were looking forward to a lot more. Some people still struggled and some people still found the darkness challenging, but a lot more people than I was used to were talking about how much they were looking forward to the snow and to skiing, how much they were excited about the coziness of what they call the dark time, how ready they felt for sort of winter to be here so they could slow down after the craziness of summer where it's actually light out all the time. And so people just seem to have more things that they could zone in on and talk about that they were sort of anticipating positively.
We're talking with Carrie Leibowitz right now, health psychologist and winter well-being expert, about how to keep our mood up during the winter season. You can call in too at 800-642-1234. How do you stay happy? How do you stay active during winter? Is it a time that you dread or do you look forward to it? Why is that? 800-642-1234. Now, Carrie, were there ways, as you mentioned, humans are kind of unique in this way that we want to power through the winter as if nothing is changing in the daylight and in our circadian rhythms. Other animals don't do that. Were there ways in Norway that you saw people kind of offsetting those physical differences in the day?
It's true. I mean, we're the only animals that try not to change our behavior when the seasons change. And, you know, in most of Wisconsin, you probably have a 6-hour or more difference between the lightest day of the year and the darkest day of the year. So assuming that that's not going to affect you or that you won't have to change your behavior is really an example of sort of fighting against the season. And so there's this line that we sort of want to walk where we admit and accept that the darkness and the season is going to affect us, but don't assume that that effect has to be negative. And so I saw people in northern Norway where the seasons are so extreme have a lot more comfort in feeling more tired in the winter. That wasn't seen as a problem or something that they should feel bad about, but it was seen as sort of a natural yearly rhythm. And so people were known to sleep more in the winter and sort of use that as a time of year to get a little bit more rest. A lot of people there do use these sort of sun lamp alarm clocks in the morning, especially when they have to get up and go to work or school and the sun isn't rising, to get some of that brightness at the beginning of the day to get us going. Another thing that I saw people doing was really working with the darkness rather than against it. So I think when it's really dark, sometimes we want to turn on all the lights in the house and sort of try to banish the darkness. But actually sort of finding the opportunity in the darkness and keeping the lights low, lighting candles, using twinkly lights, using lamps rather than bright overhead lights, sort of makes the season feel cozier and makes the darkness, you know, more of something to be enjoyed and appreciated rather than something that we want to really push away. And so they have this way of adapting to the winter and trying to change their behaviors in ways that are sort of in tune with the season.
Let's go to our callers right now. We have Karen with us in Delafield. Hi, Karen.
Hi. Just wanted to share a story. I personally kind of go down in the winter, but I have a lot of artwork that I do. I put my lights on, and that helps. But I met a woman a few years ago in Iceland. She was a Swedish woman. And I asked her, isn't it really hard for you to have this dark, dark winter for so long? And she said, no, I love it. I love it. I read my books, and I just really enjoy it. So I thought it was a very positive thing to think about.
Oh, Karen, thanks for calling in and sharing that. And Carrie, it sounds like pretty familiar to you from what you've heard and what I've seen you write about.
Absolutely. Thanks for that story, Karen. Yeah, I went to Iceland as well as part of the research I did for my book that's coming out next year called How to Winter. And in Iceland and sort of throughout Scandinavia, they have this similar view that the winter is really something to enjoy. And I think part of it comes from this idea that because the winters in these places are so extreme and the changes in light and dark are so intense, people have to find a way to embrace it. You really can't survive in a lot of these places if you're going to be really miserable for 8 or 10 months out of the year when you have these really long winters. And so I think we can learn from some of these places where the winters are harsher about how to, you know, embrace and enjoy the winter in places in the U.S. like Wisconsin, where the winters are still pretty intense and extreme, but maybe they don't have that full polar night that really forces you to pay attention and change your behavior. And Karen, you mentioned artwork at the beginning, and I think the winter is a great time for creative pursuits, for doing art, practicing and playing music, writing poetry, and really thinking of the winter as a time of year that we get to indulge in those things when we might be too busy outside to do that in the summer can really make the time of year feel special.
Karen, thanks for that call, and I am also looking forward to hunkering down and doing some painting over this winter. We're talking with health psychologist, speaker, and writer Carrie Leibowitz right now. She's sharing what she's learned about mental well-being during her time living in the Arctic Circle. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you cope with the cold and darkness of the winter season? What activities do you look forward to every winter? What about social gatherings or certain types of foods? And what are your tips for getting outdoors in the winter? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Dean Kinetter. Right now, we're picking up the talk with health psychologist, speaker, and writer Carrie Leibowitz. Her upcoming book is called How to Winter. She's giving us tips on how to beat the winter blues by making small changes to our mindset and our lifestyle. We're taking your calls, too, at 800-642-1234. Let's go to the phones now. Mark is with us in Bloomer. Hi, Mark.
Hey. So my wife and I, you know, winter was kind of a blue time. my kids got involved in a winter sport. Up here in Eau Claire, we have the Eau Claire Flying Eagles Ski Jumping Club. Now we travel to Michigan and Minnesota and Illinois and all over Wisconsin for competitions. And by golly, winter, it can be so much fun. You just got to get out and do something.
Wow. And Mark, ski jumping, are we talking the big jumps, maybe not as big as we see in the Olympics, but something like that?
Oh, you work your way up. Absolutely.
Wow. Very cool.
I'm always going to jump into 35 this year.
Wow. Awesome stuff. Well, Mark, thanks for calling in with that. And Carrie, what do you think about Mark's solution of getting outdoors for himself or for his kids?
I mean, Mark, I love it. I am way too scared to try ski jumping, but I'm very impressed. And I think the key thing here that you've picked up on is that before you had something really specific that you and your family looked forward to about the winter, it was maybe a time that was kind of blue for you. But if you have something that you only do in the winter that makes the season fun and special, then it starts to unlock all these opportunities and possibilities during this time of year and gives you something positive to anticipate. And so I think winter sports are a big one, and a lot of the people and a lot of the cultures around the world that really love and embrace winter are places that are really into winter sports.
Mark, thanks again for that call. Let's go next to Cyril in Madison. Hey, Cyril.
Hi there. I wanted to say that I look forward to winter because it's the one season of the year where I'm not sneezing or coughing or stuffed up, you know. If it's green and grows, I'm allergic to it. So winter is a relief for me. But I just wanted to mention, you know, having been up, you know, north of the circle and all, and living with the townspeople there, that not only were you getting acclimated to the environment, but you were also becoming assimilated to the social environments of the townspeople and their activities and their train of thought, so to speak.
Well, Cyril, thanks for the call. Carrie, what do you think?
Yes, definitely, Cyril. So I think our mindsets are contagious. And so even though we all as individuals have mindsets, our mindsets are influenced by the people and culture around us. And so it was a lot easier for me to change my mindset about winter and start seeing winter more positively in Tromsø, in Northern Norway, than if I had been somewhere else where that wasn't the norm. And I also think your point about allergies is really good. Another one that comes up for people is mosquitoes, which are such a unfortunate part of summer. And so I think, you know, you can also focus on, you know, some of the things that you are freed from in the winter, whether that's seasonal allergies or whether that's mosquitoes or whether it's sunburn. You know, every season has pros and cons. And so leaning into some of the pros of winter and maybe remembering some of the cons of other seasons can help you find more things to like about winter.
Yeah, that was a great example of leaning in. You know, if nothing else, the winter is at least clean. It's at least clean. Cyril, thanks for that call. Let's go next to Mike in Rusk County. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I was born and raised in far northern Wisconsin, and I mean, I love this. I love this season and going into the winter. You know, one of the things I've always said, and I think it ties into the last caller in kind of a way, is that the people that don't like winter, in my experience, are people who are more concerned about fashion than they are about comfort. You know, the thing about summer, when it gets really hot, really humid, you can't, excuse me, you cannot strip down far enough to get comfortable. But in the wintertime, you could put a sweater on. And if you're not, you know, if you wear actual good gloves, good mitts, good hats and stuff, instead of trying to be fashionable and go, and you're not going to muss up your hairdo so you don't wear a hat, and you're not going to, you know, you got to have show the pecs, so you're going to have a tight jacket to have any comfort.
Sure thing. Mike, thanks for the call. And hey, that's another example of a way to free yourself of something, free yourself of the obligation to look stylish. What do you think?
Yes. And I mean, dressing appropriately for the winter is so huge because even people who love the winter don't like the feeling of being cold. And so I think it's really important to dress warmly enough that we can be outside and we can do activities in the winter without feeling freezing. One thing I really appreciated in Northern Norway is they're very sporty there. And so there was this sort of actual overlap between what was considered stylish and fashionable and what was practical, where sort of having, you know, the right winter gear was sort of seen as very fashionable there. And I think even if you are someone who is stylish, you know, sometimes there's people who love their winter coat collection or they have a great sweater collection. And if you're someone who maybe doesn't care as much about fashion, then winter can be really a time of year into leaning into the comfort of your wardrobe and really making sure you're just snug and bundled, which I personally love.
Thanks for that call. We can go next to Tiffany in Blue River. Hey, Tiffany.
Hello. I love winter because I love to bake. And therefore, I'm not heating the house up. And as a big family event, like we go to each other's houses and we have like a little bake fest for holidays and Thanksgiving. And everybody gets to eat and be merry. And it's a really good way to connect with family and loved ones that you don't always have the time for because you're always on the go in summertime.
Tiffany, thanks for that call. Again, segmenting different parts of the year for different types of activities, Carrie.
Yes, and I think baking is a really good one, both because it's an indoor activity and, as you mentioned, Tiffany, it warms the house up. So I once met a man whose wife would not let him bake bread in the summer because it made the house too warm. And so, like you, winter was really his baking season. And so I think that's a two for one. And Dean, I got to say, we're hearing from so many winter lovers. I don't think the people of Wisconsin need me. They have all of these solutions that they're already doing.
I need this. This is a great segment for me, if for no one else out there. Well, Tiffany, thank you so much for that call. I think we've got time for one more call. Let's go to Julie joining us from Lincoln, Nebraska. Hi, Julie.
Well, hello. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to call. I'm a transplanted badger, and I love winter. I look forward to it. I look forward to staying on regular time, not daylight savings. But I had two comments. One is that apparently the Norwegian language has a saying that says that there's no bad weather, there's only bad clothes.
And that's exactly right. Thanks, Julie. Yeah.
And the other thing is when they do these surveys of the happiest countries in the world, why are most of them in Scandinavia?
Gotcha. Where? Julie, thanks so much for the call. We just have about 1 minute left or so. Carrie, your final thoughts on what Julie had to say or any other things you want to leave us with for a pep talk heading into winter?
Yeah, well, I will say that our mindsets really matter, but so does the context that we're in. And so a quick answer to Julie's questions is a lot of these countries have really strong social safety nets. They have, you know, things like good childcare, parental leave, education, and healthcare. And so I think we can all work on our individual mindsets. And then those things can help changing the culture so that we start being surrounded by other people who also love and enjoy and appreciate winter so that we can all find the joy and fun in the season together.
Well, Carrie, this has been a lot of fun. Thank you so much for taking the time and talking with us today.
Thanks. It's been just a delight.
Carrie Leibowitz is a health psychologist, speaker, and writer. Her upcoming book is How to Winter. That'll be out next fall. We talked with her about how to embrace and enjoy the dark and cold Wisconsin winters. Thanks to all of you for calling in, too. You can keep the conversation going on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let us know if you like winter, if you dislike it, and what keeps your mood up when it's cold and dark. Post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. I'm Dean Knetter in for Rob Ferret. More to come. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.